Training to become a surgeon can feel like training for the Olympics. Then we finish and we realize we're just adults with jobs. Life after training is an entirely different landscape. You need to get to know you. What does success mean for you? What brings you joy? What's your purpose? I'm Dr. Mel Thacker, an ear, nose, and throat surgeon and coach. I'm here to help surgeons like you rediscover themselves. Welcome to Surgeons with Purpose. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Today, I am super excited. My guest today is Dr. Geeta Pensa. I am such a girl fan for her because I have followed her for a really long time. She is the creator of an incredible podcast that everyone needs to listen to. It's called The L Word, Doctors in Litigation. She's also an adjunct associate professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Brown. And she's widely recognized as one of the nation's leading experts on malpractice, litigation stress, and physician litigation support. In addition to her podcast, she also goes around the world speaking. She's the editor of the Academic Emergency Medicine Journal's monthly research podcast through 2024. She was awarded a Special Service Recognition Award from Rhode Island for courageous public advocacy of Rhode Island emergency medicine colleagues. And she's been featured in forums such as Time Magazine, SXSW, NPR, and the new PBS documentary, A World of Hurt, How Medical Malpractice Fails Everyone. You can find more about her at doctorsinlitigation.com. And I will leave all of the links for her to get a hold of her in the show notes. So thank you so much for coming on, Geeta. Is that okay if I call you Geeta?
Please. Can I call you Mel?
Absolutely. Yes.
I'm so happy to be here, Mel. Thank you for having me.
So I know your story. I feel like I know you because of how much you've been in my ears on your podcast. But for our listeners, can you give us the cliff notes of how you went from being an ER doctor to a podcaster and coach and speaker?
Yeah, sure. So I'm an ER doc by training. I started working as an attending in my first emergency medicine job back in 2001. And in that job, I was a nocturnist in a community hospital. I would be the only doctor in the hospital at night. So even though we had labor and delivery, even though we had a 6-bed ICU, we had no anesthesia, we had nobody. It was me in the hospital. We didn't have hospitals. So I would like run upstairs from the ER and take care of business and come back down. And it was terrifying, you could imagine. But I also felt like I was really good at it. I just felt like this is my jam. This is where I'm supposed to be. It felt great. And about 5 years out of residency, which is when I think that's about when people really start to hit their stride, as attendings, I saw this woman. You would think that the case that totally changed the trajectory of my life would have been one of these forays to labor and delivery or something like that. And it was not. It was this woman who came in to the emergency department in the middle of the night complaining of eye pain. And I spent a lot of time with her. It didn't make sense. The whole thing was just a weird presentation. And I really did puzzle over it. And I imaged her and I called a consultant and I really thought about it hard. And I wound up discharging her with a plan in place to see the consultant at 9 a.m. And she didn't get there. She went home and she had a massive cerebellar stroke. Mm-hmm. And she was 30 years old and an engineer. And so anyone that knows anything about litigation will know that if you have a young person and significant disabilities and they had a good job and you live in a state where there aren't any sort of limits on anything, that someone's going to come after you and ask for the moon. And that is what happened. And so I got named in a lawsuit shortly after that. And I did not know the first thing about it because no one had ever taught me anything. I had learned about risk management, but the implication was to me that I couldn't name anybody in my training program or like no one had talked about what happened after you got named. And once that finger was pointed at your face, like, what did you do? I had no idea. And it seemed to me that it didn't happen to good doctors. Like, that's why they didn't teach us. Mm-hmm. And I was also really torn apart with guilt over what happened to this patient. I cared a lot about it. I used to lay awake at night wondering, I couldn't put it all together. And so there was a lot of suffering, and that sort of began this descent into madness. And the whole thing lasted in total 12 years. I went on trial in 2011 as the only face of it, the only physician defendant in a case where the demand was $28 million. Oh my God. And so, of course, there was a lot of fear and anxiety around that. Like, where am I going to get $28 million from? And just so much pain. I was pregnant with my third kid at the time I saw this patient. Just misery all around. And I kept going to work because I didn't know what else to do, even though I desperately wanted to run away. I would cry in my car. I'd pull up and I would like cry. And then I'd be like, okay, like I got to go in. And then I would just watch the clock and just, you know, do my job and just like pray for the whole thing to be over. And then I'd go home, and then eventually I'd come back and do it again. But I went on trial in 2011. It's a lot. We can talk about that. I mean, I was as prepared as my lawyer could get me, but like emotionally completely, completely unprepared. And I don't remember a lot of it. It was 4.5 weeks. Somehow they got me to testify for a couple of days. I don't know how, but there was a defense verdict. And then they appealed it. And then it wound up going through all the layers of the courts. And in 2015, they overturned my verdict and said, okay, you have to go back to trial again. And I thought I might die. Like, I really did. And so that is sort of the beginning of the saga that turned into the podcast and reinvention and just reclaiming who I am. And that was the pivotal moment, I think, when I just decided, like, am I going to die here at the bottom of the hole where I've been for 8 years?
Yeah.
Or am I going to do something about it?
Yeah. Do you know how common it is for a physician to be sued and then have it overturned and have to go through that misery twice?
I am an outlier. I'm going to say, I mean, it was sort of this perfect storm of, Rhode Island is a state with a terrible, terrible, terrible malpractice climate. And I had no idea about that before. And I think that most of us are not well aware until we start tangling with our systems, yeah, the state of malpractice and litigation and how plaintiff friendly certain places are. We don't have any sense of that until we get named, and then we start learning pretty fast how things work. And so I am definitely an outlier. Like most people, you know, this thing's going to be wrapped up in 3 to 5 years. And most people don't go to trial. Really, you know, maybe 10% of cases altogether go to trial. Mm-hmm. And it is the rare bird that has to do it twice.
So you went twice on the same patient, same case.
Same patient, same case, 12 years, trial in 2011. But I'll say I went to trial the second time in 2018, and I was 100% a different person walking into that courtroom. 100%.
Yeah. I remember listening to that and how you brought residents in to watch you.
Yeah.
For that second trial, and how brilliant that was to give them the exposure, and how I would have loved to have that.
You know, and it's so interesting because, yes, I did do that. I was really highly confident, not that I would necessarily win, because you can never predict what a jury is going to do, but I was very highly confident in my skills and in my competence as a witness. And I knew going in there, like, I'm going to own this room and I'm going to teach these residents how it's done. How else are they going to know? This is my whole mission. Once I had gained some degree of just like equanimity and understanding and balance, and there's a whole lot that went into achieving that, and I learned a lot about tort law and legal performance as part of that. Once I knew what I was doing, then my mission became, how do I make the thing that I wished I'd had? Like, how do I shortcut this for somebody else? And then this was available to me, the trial. And I really thought, you know, let's just have, I did, I'm not saying I did that easily. There was definitely some internal debate over whether that was a good idea. And then I, you know, I talked to the residency director and she was like, if you want to do it, I'm sure they would love it. And I did, I really did. And so I will say though, not all of them came. And there was one in particular, he and I had a pretty jokey relationship and I'd be like, you know, be there. And he'd be like, I don't know. And I'd be like, you need to be there. You need to be there. And I really thought he was going to be there. And he did not come. And so after it was all done, I was like, dude, where were you? And he was very serious. He was not jokey at all then. He was just like, honestly, Dr. Pensa, I could not watch you do that. I just couldn't. I didn't think I could handle seeing it. And I was like, you know what? I need you to be able to do it.
Yeah.
Like, how are you going to do it? You might have to do it. And so it's hard, even though you offer people the opportunity, some people would jumped at it and other people were just, they were just too scared. They were just too scared to even come and watch.
Yeah, it's very big. And I mean, I love how, you know, you came out the other end. There's two sides of your story. There's like the first one where it just derailed you and sent you down this, you know, into misery and suffering. And then there's the other side where you create something from it and you have this huge impact and you're such a resource for all of us. And you, like you said, you became a different person and it's just such a beautiful thing and such a beautiful story. But I'd love to go back to the time when you were first served and mm-hmm. what that was like for you. What kind of emotions you felt? Where were you? How did it happen? How did it go down? Because that's something I don't think we even know. Like, what does that mean to get served with patients?
Yeah. Well, I was at the hospital, but I was notified by my chairman. Oh. So I didn't get served by a process server per se. I got served like by, it was sort, it felt sort of like friendly fire, but our group was also named. And so that's why he got served, cause he was the chair and then he was allowed to receive the summons on my behalf. And so that's what happened. And so I basically got handed this thing and I don't remember what he said. I don't think I heard anything after. And then I just went to this back room by myself and I opened the thing and I wanted to vomit. I don't think I cried because I was at work, but I was definitely in a state where I just felt like the whole world, like just shifted on its axis mm-hmm. all of a sudden. And I couldn't grasp at all what was happening, what had happened, how possibly could this had happened. And then in came the desire to just, all I wanted to do was to call the plaintiff. That's all I was overwhelmed by, this desire to talk to the patient yeah. and explain, which is obviously you can't do that, but I just wanted to talk to her. I wanted to see her. I wanted to ask about how I could help, like make it anything better. Like I was finding out way too late. Like obviously I didn't even know, because she got taken to a tertiary care center and I did not know what happened to her. I just never got that feedback. This is one of the dangers of emergency medicine, is sometimes you don't find out when terrible things happen. And so I just felt like utterly blindsided, and I could feel this whole identity that I had constructed in those 5 years being, you know, what I thought was a total badass running a whole hospital at night by herself. It just evaporated.
Wow.
It just instantly evaporated. And I had no idea that it had been so tenuous, but it was gone. It was just gone. And I didn't know what to do with any of it. And I didn't know the first thing I was supposed to do. Like the chair had to tell me, like, you've got to call our carrier. I don't know who our carrier is. What do you mean our carrier? What's a carrier? Like mm-hmm. you have insurance, like you have to call them and you have to start talking to the claims people. You are going to get an attorney. Like all of that stuff had to unfold. But I didn't, you know, it took me a long time, several minutes to be like, oh, okay, what am I supposed to do with this? You know, I had to read the complaint. I couldn't even make it through like the first time before I was like, I'm going to vomit.
Yeah.
Cause it's written in very strong language.
Yeah.
Basically to, you know, it's really the, you know, and you find out when I'll explain in the podcast how it really is this sort of shot across the bow. Like they will phrase things very forcefully so that, you know, to really convey the gravity of the situation to you. And also the reason why they're going to ask for so much money.
You remember that in your particular letter?
Oh God, no, I can't remember. I mean, if you ask me to remember what it felt like, it was just like, you are the world's worst doctor. You are a terrible human being. You are absolutely evil. You ruin people's lives. Like, you ought to be locked up. That's what it felt like reading it. I'm sure it said none of those things verbatim, but if you ask me to recall.
That's what you made it mean.
That's what I made it mean. That's what I made it mean.
We would all make it mean.
Yeah. And it was pretty awful. And I don't remember, I honestly don't remember how did I get home? What did I do after that? I don't remember calling the carrier. I must have done that at some point. Like, there's a lot that I don't remember. And part of it is time, because that was 2006. And part of it is just like, I think I blocked a lot of stuff out.
Yeah, I mean,
it was traumatic. Yeah, it is trauma. It is trauma. Anything that like completely dissolves your identity in a second is traumatic.
Yeah. And especially an identity that we spend so much time and energy and effort and money to create. And then when we hold it and we're so attached to it, you're like, I'm the badass. Like, I go all through the hospital. I'm delivering babies. I'm taking care of a whole hospital. I'm helping all these people. And it's like all of the people you helped, all the babies you delivered, all the patients that did well, the heart attacks that you identified and like lives you saved, it didn't matter. It all disappeared. Nope. It disappeared with that identity in that one moment for you.
That's exactly true. That's exactly true. And it was inaccessible to me. All I could think about was this lawsuit and the fear it inspired. And that seeped into everything I did at home. Like, it was just everywhere. It took over. It took over. And whenever I'd built about my own identity and, all the thoughts I'd had about who I was, they sort of, disintegrate is a great word. It was just gone. It was gone.
And who was left?
Oh, it's like a horribly miserable shell of a person who, well, you know, it's interesting. Doctors are pretty tough, right? In general, your surgeon, your listeners are mostly surgeons. Like, who's tougher than a woman surgeon?
Nobody.
That's the reality of it, right? So I was able to, I never hit the point where I couldn't go to work or I couldn't do the stuff that I had been like assigned by life to do, right? I was not, I really wasn't present for my children the way I would want to be. I was very short tempered with my spouse. And I'm sure that there were moments where I was like, I kind of had it all together, except that in the back of my mind always, but very often in the front was this traumatic thing and this worry about what was going to happen and the fear and the anxiety and largely the shame.
Yeah.
And here I am operating now. Now I never struggled with imposter anything until this happened. I really thought I was good at what I did.
Yeah.
And now I was showing up at work and pretending to be a good doctor when now I knew I wasn't.
Yeah.
And the fear was really palpable of like, what am I going to miss now? Who am I going to hurt today? But I couldn't quit because we had loans. We had three kids. I had felt like I had no other marketable skills. Like, I could crack a chest. That's it. Like, what am I going to do? And I did not want to quit and like work for an insurance company. I didn't. That was literally all I could think that I was like, that I could possibly do. The only other option. And so I just kept doing the things I was doing. I was going through it, but I really was a deeply unhappy, depressed, highly anxious, reactive person who was 100% at the effect of the lawsuit.
And it's so fascinating what that trauma does this. And some of us go through a trauma when we train, not everybody, but mm-hmm. some of us do because it is so rigorous and it can be mm-hmm. toxic. And when we're in that trauma brain and you were in that trauma brain in 2006, it's like everything is black or white. Like mm-hmm. either I win or I lose. Either I am a good doctor, I'm a bad doctor. Either I stay and I'm still an ER doctor or I leave and I work for an insurance company. Like it's mm-hmm. this or that. And you mm-hmm. have no capacity to see all shades of gray. So how did you get yourself from that like all or none black or white traumatized shell of a person to someone who could see her options and essentially be the architect of her own reality?
Well, then we have to fast forward from 2006 to 2015. And it took a long time, right? It took a long time. I mean, you would think that 2011, when I won at trial, would have been like, that would have been some return to normalcy. And it was not. In my mind, it was better than losing. But I still felt, I didn't want to do ER anymore. I didn't like it anymore. I was always afraid. Mm-hmm. I had not really returned. And it's interesting, even though all those years, like 8 years in, seven years in, I'm not doing the math right because I'm on the spot. But anyway, it was a long time. I had saved lots of lives in between. Like I hadn't hurt anybody in between. I was doing a really good job in between, and I could not register that. All I could think about was this. And in 2015, I remember when there probably had been some sort of pre-contemplation of like, you know, you probably need some help. You know, you could probably do things a little differently. And someone gave me a book called When Good Doctors Get Sued. They just sort of left it. I knew who it was, but they left it at my workstation. And I was not grateful at the time. I was some sort of mix of like terribly ashamed and incensed. Mm-hmm. That someone would think that I needed a self-help book. And I did not read it. And then I took it home and I put it in the drawer of my nightstand. And once in a while I would open the drawer and I would see the title When Good Doctors Get Sued. And it would be like, oh, I guess good doctors get sued. Like that felt okay. Like that was helpful. Mm-hmm. But I didn't read it. And in 2015, I got my lawyer called me. And my lawyer had been an ex-Army Special Forces guy. He was a tremendous lawyer. But he did not have a lot of patience for my
trauma.
My trauma. Like, he is the sort of guy that if you actually said the word trauma, he would, like, I don't know what he would do, but he would, like, roll his eyes and be like, for God's sake. Like, just... and he essentially told me in that conversation, like, you have to do it again. You're going to put your big girl pants on. You already did it once. You're going to do it again. And that's kind of that. And I, in my head, was like, you're going to have to find somebody else. Like, I don't know what to tell you. I can't do this. Yeah. I won't do this. And then so, you know, I hung up and I was crying and crying and crying and crying because I could not imagine doing it again. And I definitely had thoughts about suicide or like, I'm not going to do this. I can't do this for one more day. And I think it was in that recognition of like, oh my God, like I scared myself. Mm-hmm. And then I had what I called my sort of my epiphany, my Scarlett O'Hara moment, which was basically like, I finally put my head up and I was like, okay, I will do this again, but with God as my witness, I am not going to be like this again. I don't know how. I don't know where I'm going to get the help, but that was the first day that I was like, maybe I should look outside my own echo chamber of a head for help. It was literally the first day that I was like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to, like, I don't know how to do it. Somebody show me how to do it. And I went upstairs and I read that book.
Yeah.
Like I took it as I had the idea, like, oh, there's a book in my nightstand. Maybe I should go read it.
That's helped probably many doctors.
Yeah. And so I went upstairs and I finally started reading it. And I will say it didn't, in the beginning, it felt weird. It felt like indulgence. It felt, I don't know, it felt like some like terrible admission of weakness that I would be doing this. Cause I was just a super help resistant person, as we have been trained to be.
Yeah.
And then I noticed that it felt helpful.
Yeah.
And allowing myself to notice that it felt helpful was a very good thing for me, because then that broke what I call the self-help seal, where I was like, oh, I wonder if I could get another book that might help me.
Oh gosh, once you go down that rabbit hole.
And then you start going down the rabbit hole. But I became a student. So I was approaching this very much with a student's mindset, mm-hmm. where I was like going to scientifically appraise the things in the book. So I would get books and I would read them and I would write things in the margin. I don't know where I found the time at the time to do it, but I was very determined that I was going to do this. And I would try things with a degree of earnestness that I had just never had before. And I would realize like, that works. Okay, that's kind of helpful. Or sometimes I'd think things were dumb. And that it's interesting. Sometimes I would come back to them and be like, it's not so dumb. Not so dumb, actually. But, you know, it would take, it's like introducing baby food where you have to try like a new food like 10 times before the baby is like, oh, okay, this isn't that disgusting. That was me with a lot of these concepts. And gradually it's, you know, and then I started, when I was braver, I started making changes at work. I began to see, I felt safe enough to think like, okay, I might be able to think creatively about this. I might be able to learn new things. And in the process of learning the new things, because I will say too, that with litigation, to a certain extent, when the outcome is bad and you feel responsible, even if you don't, even if you can't figure out what the heck you did wrong, you will usually assume that it was you, like something happened and you missed it somehow, right? Or sometimes you know what you did.
Yeah.
There is an element of feeling that you don't deserve to feel better.
Yes. That you have to suffer and because someone else.
You have to suffer. And that was, I was stuck in that for a long time. Like that to me, I had been sentenced to a life of misery. And that is what I deserved. I deserved to live in misery. And so why would I try to feel better if that was what was supposed to happen? If that's what I made it mean, if that was supposed to happen, why would I look outside myself? And so I had to really frighten myself and to think, to get to the point where I think I really might need to, I might need help.
Yeah.
Now, could I have like actually at that time called a therapist? Like it took a long time before I saw a therapist. It took a long time before I got coaching, but there was, I had to achieve a certain like recognition of my helplessness before I was like, okay, I guess I do need help.
Yeah. There's so many things that come up for me when you talk about that. Cause like one is that we do have to almost look at the result we're trying to create and we forget to do that. So it's like, oh, let me sentence myself to suffering because that's what I do. It's like, what kind of result will that create? Well, I won't be able to be present for my family. I won't be able to be present for whatever job I choose, for my husband, for my friends. And
well, I'd never been taught to think like that.
I know
I, that before I encountered like therapy, coaching, all that, like I had lived quite well, I think, just sort of reacting to my circumstances and my own thoughts. And like, I thought I was doing a good job. And I also thought that I was smarter than the average bear.
Yeah. A lot of
and, us. Yeah. So like, why would I need to think about my thinking?
Right. We're not regular humans. We're
superhumans. We are superhumans. We're absolutely superhumans. Oh yeah. Right. Well, that's one of the first things you have to come to terms with.
Yeah.
Before you let some random PhD help you or not even a real doctor.
Exactly. Then it also like expands the brain. Cause like, it is like, I talk about this in one of my podcasts, how fear and like anything that's an amygdala hijack, anything coming from the left emotional brain. And this all comes from like Jill Bolte Taylor's, she's a Harvard neuroanatomist, like book, The Whole Brain Living, how we have these characters in our brain. And when we're in that left emotional brain, which we jump between left emotional and left intellectual, when we're training, it's like, oh, fear of complications, fear of litigation, fear of whatever. You know, fear of all, that's all that cover your ass medicine. And then you're in intellectual, let me figure this out. What do I know for sure? And we're never in the right side where it's creativity and curiosity and connection and compassion, all those beautiful C emotions. And
courage.
They all live in that right side, connectedness, especially. And it's like, you almost had like a breakthrough is what I'm hearing, where you were in left, like in fear, and then you broke out into a little bit of curiosity. And now you're like, ooh, let me learn and let me take notes. And now you're like a little baby, like learning again. I think of my son when he was a little scientist. He's 11 now, but I remember watching him when he was like 4 months old, grabbing an object, putting it in his mouth, and then grabbing it with the other hand. And I was like, wow, he's got like a process to like to experiment and get to know the world around him.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Very much so. And I, there is a quote, there's a Bruce Lee quote. Now, if people don't know Bruce Lee, the martial artist who had a brief but spectacular life, I only know, not, I'm not a martial artist. I only know about him because I have a nephew who is autistic and very into martial arts and became highly obsessed with Bruce Lee. And so I did learn all about Bruce Lee. And then in the telling of it, I was like, wow, he's really cool, you know? But he has a quote about researching your own experience and absorbing what is useful and rejecting what is useless and then adding what is specifically your own. And that is what I knew myself to be doing. And that's why I think when I learned that quote, that's why it stuck with me. Another one of his is to be like water. And there is, which is a very interesting concept, but, and I encourage everybody to read about, he died so young, but he did so much so creatively. That was it. I began because I recognized that I didn't have the answers. And when I looked outside, there were some books about litigation, not a lot, but they weren't enough for me to really heal my head, I guess, and to make me better. And then when I started branching off into reading other things, and I had always been interested in, before I was a doctor, when I was young, I was interested in philosophy, and I was really interested in Eastern philosophy, and my father had been a monk. My father's living, knocking wood. He's going to be 94 soon. And he was born in 1931 in very rural colonial India.
I have so many questions, but
I know. And he grew up in an ashram and he was there until his 20s. And then he left for a secular life. But that philosophy was always infused in our home growing up. I had a mother who was very religiously dogmatic. Mm-hmm. And my dad, who was much more of a curious guy. And he was a very creative person, is a very creative person. But he had like 50 patents. And like, that was in there somewhere.
Beautiful.
And it was gone. Like I went to medical school and I was so focused on being a doctor the right way that I very much learned how to think like a doctor. I like became somebody with this like pretty narrow-minded algorithmic. This is the way we do things. This is who we are. This is our personality. Like this is, and I had always been a very good adapter, right? I was a kid of immigrants. There weren't a lot of brown kids where I grew up. Our goal was to assimilate. That was the mantra back then, was assimilate. And so I was really good at picking up how I was supposed to behave and changing myself in order to be who I was supposed to be in some sort of a situation. Yeah. And when I got to medical school, man, boy, did I, you know, not tooting my own horn, I'm just saying like I won this award at graduation. I won a graduation award for embodying the qualities of the ideal physician. And I took that so much to heart, right? But what are the qualities of the ideal physician? Like when you sort of dig into it, like, you know, were they like praising my creativity or were they praising my, no, I was all the things that you would think of in terms of like the person who left last and the person who like, just like had their nose on the grindstone all the time. And just, I was a nice person. I think my patients liked me, but I assimilated, baby. That's what I did.
You're a chameleon.
And then I forgot. Yeah. I had absolute amnesia to the things that I stopped using. Mm-hmm. And it was really trying to go back in time and recall, hey, like you used to be able to do this. And when I would read, I read philosophy again. I read all sorts of stuff. And I think it was, part of it was just in unburdening myself of this notion that the only thing I was ever supposed to read was a medical journal. Back when we read medical journals, like, they would come to your house and read them. Yeah. And really, as soon as I allowed myself to start thinking creatively, it started to come back. Yeah. And then I was like, there is no right way to do this. There is a right way to be a doctor, apparently. But this part that I'm doing now, I got to make up on my own. And how do you do that?
Yeah. And speaking of that, and I want to get into this because I love this whole notion. This is one big takeaway I got from your podcast, is that everything is a game. And that really changed it for me. I was like, oh my gosh, like if he, the judge is hungry and it's like, you're the last case and he doesn't have time for this. Or if there's some sort of relationship with the prosecutor and the judge, and it's like humans are at the end of everything and everything yeah. game. And that, and so yeah. it doesn't honestly matter if, you know, who's in the right or who's in the wrong, because it's a human thing. The humans are the ones that decide.
The humans are the one that decide. And I mean, it is, I will say it's a game. It's a dangerous game. It feels very, how do I want to say this? It feels very much like a lot about you rides on the outcome. Like you're not invested in the outcome. And so it's not like it's not a game in terms of like the spirit in which you're approaching it, but the strategy by which you win. No, it's not a fun game, but the strategy by which you approach it is like a chess game. It is very much by understanding all the moving parts. And it's just like, you know, when you work in an institution for a long time and you need to figure out how to get something done, it's very different when you know the scrub tech, when you know the who's on the desk, who can I call? Oh, this person's the nurse manager today. Like if you know all that stuff, you're going to get your thing done. You are going to figure out how to get it done. If you know the anesthesiologist, if you know this, like, oh God, so-and-so is on today. Let's get that done. If you know how to operate like that, you're going to win. You're going to win your day, right? Like that's how, it's not because like the clouds part and you, it just happens for you. You got to make that happen. Right. And so the more you know about how this system works, who is who, what the motivations are of all the various people, how do they decide whether a case gets settled or not? Like, who do I have to be? And yeah, maybe you do need to be a little bit of a chameleon to like, how do you adapt? Mm-hmm. How do I show up? What is the most advantageous thing for me? What is the most advantageous way to be? And I tell people, you know, when I coach them, that the most important thing that we learn how to do is to recognize, you know, we have two goals. One is to process all of the really heavy emotional, because this is, you know, no matter if we say it's a game, like people will say it's just business, it doesn't feel like that.
No,
and
not
you
at all.
Do have to do something with these feelings. You got to process it, all your feelings about the medical event, your guilt around it, your desire for someone out there to forgive you for whatever it is that you did wrong. But who's going to do that? Like there's no room for forgiveness in medicine. How do you work through all of that stuff? That's one goal. And the other goal is to learn how to be a good defendant, which everybody ought to know how to be. How to be an asset to your defense. I don't care what happened. Like, how are you an asset to your defense? Because I mean, even if you're just defending the practice of medicine in general, like there, you do deserve to defend yourself. Like you are out there doing your best every single day in an arena that is completely fraught with risk and the potential for harm. And, you know, it's a given, like, and it's a given that someone, that you'll make a mistake sometime. And it's a given that your outcome will be poor sometimes when you wanted it to be great. Whatever that stew is, I don't care. You have the right to defend either yourself or the practice of medicine. You do. But you have to learn how to do those two things separately. This is a non-intersecting Venn diagram of skills.
Yeah. It's so fascinating because like that one, I almost feel like you can't be the good defendant unless you really get down to the truth of what you're thinking. Like maybe we're thinking like, I hate that patient or that was so unfair. Like I want to do really awful things to them. And if we try to, you know, almost like virtue signal and pretend like, oh, I'm above having those thoughts when they're really just brewing underneath the surface, I feel like it's not easy to be a good defendant when you don't
know
through, right?
No, it's not. It's going to come out, right? Yeah. So if you are not managing your emotions, you will be a very reactive defendant. Yeah. And what plaintiff's attorneys are very skilled at doing is yanking your chain.
Yeah.
They're very good at it because they understand that's the game. They understand us very, very well. They are trained to do this, right? They are trained in the art of manipulation. And it's not, that doesn't make them bad. That just makes them good at their jobs, right? That's their job. Their job is to win, not to find out the truth. Their job is to win. So if you think about the criminal system, These lawyers go to school. What they are taught, the thing that is right and just and good, is for them to zealously defend the rights of their client. And they don't care really whether or not, you know, there's a good explanation for the thing you did. Their job is to win, right? And that you will have a lot of emotions about that. That is processed in circle one.
Yep.
Circle two is you showing up, recognizing that to be a fact, not reacting to that, to have whatever reframe is required for you to be like calm and professional. And it could be that you think about that plaintiff's attorney as a borderline patient. It could be that you think about him as an angry family member, because you know how to stay professional in those moments and just keep coming with your truth, right? I understand the misunderstanding. Let me explain. Like, that's a very different attitude than seeing that person as this like hostile man who's, or woman who's out to take everything that was held dear to you, right? There are skills that you can acquire that will help you. But yeah, you got to manage all your feelings about this. Like, you have to be able to understand, process, feel deeply, move through your emotions about it, so that you can show up with equanimity and do your job. And we know how to do that, because we do it every day at work. Yes. We do it every day at work. You manage your emotions at work. You got all sorts of emotions about things that are happening with your patients or what, but you know how to put that somewhere and show up and go to the OR and do your freaking job. We all do that, right? You just need to know how to do your job here.
And be politely interested, if I remember.
And be politely interested. Right. Yeah. So when it's not your turn to talk, then you're just going to be politely interested. I mean, they're not going to, you know, since then that was the advice that my attorney gave me. I've evolved that somewhat to people. I do want you to look interested. Sometimes I feel like you don't necessarily have to look that polite, but you can, you know, a hint of like, you know.
You're engaged.
A hint, like, yeah, you don't want to look happy all the time, but yeah. but politely interested is probably, you know, is probably when I think about it now, it's probably a good advice. But yeah, you, when you're not talking at trial, that's your job, is to look like you're invested and to look like you are in control.
Yeah. And so I want to respect your time, and we're coming to an end, and we didn't really get into the details of your case, but I guess everyone's going to have to go listen to your podcast to get all of that. And I highly recommend that you do. It is so good. But the last piece I wanted to touch on is the expert witness.
Oh gosh. Yeah.
And I know we don't have too much time, but I would love for you to give us your thoughts about expert witnesses. Cause I think I changed my whole, I was offered actually, cause somebody came to me, a law firm came to me and asked me to be an expert witness. And I was deeply in your podcast, and I had a lot of negative thoughts and feelings towards expert witnesses. And there was no way I wanted to identify as one. I told them like flatly, no, there's absolutely no way I'm going to do this. But what are your thoughts about expert witnesses?
I think you should do it.
Okay.
So I think the thing is that we need good experts. We need good experts. The way the system works, the jury doesn't understand medicine. The judge doesn't understand medicine. And so the jury of lay people need experts to explain to them what the standard of care would be in a given situation. Now, of course, standard of care, we get into this in the podcast, is like, it's not a standard of care, right? There are interpretations of what would be reasonable to do in a given situation. And many doctors who work as experts don't understand this, and they approach it like it's M&M, and their goal is that this doctor did not achieve perfect care. And so they will really criticize everything that wasn't done perfectly, because that's just how we're taught to do things. And so those are the well-meaning experts who will over criticize somebody else's care, because that's because they don't know really what they're supposed to be doing, because we get no training. Mm-hmm. Then there are the people who are, we refer to as testaliers, a term of Louise Andrews, the testaliers, who will say anything for a buck. And there's a lot of bucks involved, and they make a career out of this. And anything, because any case, you can't have a med mal case go forward without an expert to say that there was malpractice. Mm-hmm. And so the only way that we can keep unless there's like significant tort reform, the only way to keep the crazy cases out would be to say like they can't find an expert to say that there was negligence, but they can always scrape the bottom of the barrel and find one of these testifiers to come around and say, sure, I'll say that. How much are you paying me? And that's the problem. We need to like we need to get rid of them. And that's happening in our own house. That's in the house of medicine. And we have not figured out how, because experts are highly protected under the law, we have to figure out how to police our own in this regard. But we also need, if all that's around are the people who will say anything for a buck, and there's nobody out there doing good work who is able to understand the standard of care and apply it, we do need, plaintiffs do get hurt. Like sometimes plaintiffs do deserve some degree of compensation for sometimes physicians are liable. And so we need people, doctors who are willing to step up and do the right thing in that circumstance too. But we need better training systems around it. We need ethics trainings. We need certifications. There's no such thing. And if you want to know, like the only thing that is more hush hush than who is getting sued around you is who is doing expert work.
Wow.
And so we need to get that out of the dark.
Yeah.
And bring that into the light. And I do know some institutions require, I believe the Mayo Clinic requires people to disclose if they're doing expert work, and that would maybe lend to needing their testimonies reviewed. But we've got to come up with something like that.
Yeah. And I think I was like, I don't want to be one of those people who's like,
I know. I mean, I should say I don't do expert work. I do plenty of other experts, but it's not really because of that. It's just, we do need good people to do expert work, but please, 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 don't get your training at one of these like fly by night things where that plaintiff's bars mostly sponsor. You know, we've got it. That'll be like in another life. I'll come up with some sort of ethics training for expert witnesses. That's what I want to do.
Yeah, no, that would be beautiful.
I feel on the list. Somebody needs to do that. Somebody who's listening, do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Wouldn't that just completely revolutionize and like give us a little layer of protection? And
I would love to see that. I would love to see some sort of certification program for ethical expert witnesses. And then when you've got a testifier up there, you know, you ask them like, you know, did you take this ethics training? Oh, you didn't. That looks bad. Or did you, you know, can I remind you of like what's in your ethical witness? But there has to be some teeth, right? There's got to be a consequence to being able to show in their testimony that they did not adhere to these ethical standards. Yeah, I got a lot of thoughts about that. But we need good experts because of the way the system works right now to show up for our fellow doctors who did do the job right, and to show up for plaintiffs who really do deserve some modicum, you know, that they deserve some compensation for what happened. But the money ruins everything. The money is tainting. There are people who make millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars doing this, and there's nobody policing it at all. And so we need to be the ones to police it.
Yeah. Well, we're coming to an end. And my last question for you would be, when my listeners get sued, because the majority of us will get sued, or if you get sued, you're able to get through without getting sued, wonderful. But when you do, or if you do, what is your biggest, most useful piece of advice for them?
All right. The one takeaway I would say is to really truly understand that you and your life and your career are so much more than this one case. Your lens will get super hyper-focused on this mistake because that's the way we're trained. We're trained to learn about our mistakes. But, and I think in coaching, you can learn to do this, books, whatever, just widen the aperture, see the good that you do every day. I want you to notice the things that you're doing every day that are nothing short of miraculous. I mean, have a deep respect for what you were taught to do and the things that you are capable, like the ways in which you help people, the, you know, what you wanted to be when you were a med student. None of that has gone away, but notice it. Notice it every day that you go to work. Because you will notice when the thing goes wrong and when you get sued, this will be happening. But just if you can hear my voice in your head telling you that you are much more than this, you are being called to defend yourself for something that happened. And you do deserve to defend yourself and you deserve to be okay. Even if something bad happens, you are going to grieve that thing and but you deserve to work through it and come back to a degree of professional courage and equanimity. And you do deserve to be joyful again and enjoy your career, but you have to remember that your career in medicine is so much more than this case and the case itself doesn't have a lot to do with your care a lot of the time. But that's probably where I would leave it.
Yeah, I love that. Well, if they need to work with you, do you offer coaching?
I do.
Is that possible?
It is possible. Okay. I am doing one-to-one coaching. I'm going to start offering. I did, and then I stopped, and again, going to start offering group coaching too in 2025. I also have a course that's going to come out in 2025. It's a 6-hour video course, and you can opt into a webinar that I'm going to do every month with that, with CME.
Love it.
And so, because the coaching has got, I mean, I will say I have a wait list.
Very high touch. Coaching. Yeah.
It's very high touch I do a lot of witness prep work. And so I'm fairly busy. And so I've been trying to think creatively about ways that I can, that I can really expand my reach. But please don't let that deter you. Just get in touch with me through my website.
It's
doctorsandlitigation.com. And a small correction, the name of the podcast is Doctors and Litigation, the L word. So if you're Googling it, the Doctors and Litigation part is first.
Okay, perfect. I always remember it as the L word.
I wanted to just call it the L word, but like there was an old Showtime show, series called the L. There are other L words. So if you go looking for it that way, you're going to find something else.
Yeah, I watched that show. Yeah.
Not at all to do with litigation.
No, different L word. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Kita.
It's been such a pleasure. I admire what you're doing, and I want to hear more of it. So keep going.
Yay. Thank you.
Such a great interview. Kita is such a wealth of knowledge, and I hope you all got so much from that discussion. One big point I want to drive home is the widening of the aperture. That is part of the mission of this podcast, is to really widen our aperture, get us out of our narrow silos, and to start to see the world clearly. We were once bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, idealistic kids who wanted to help people. And then we got smacked with a big dose of reality. And so we have to understand that reality, not to vilify the reality, but to really understand it so that when it falls on us and it falls into our corner and we're faced with something like a lawsuit or a complication or some horrible mental health issue, I want you guys to be ready. And that's the whole purpose of this podcast. I want you guys to become master surfers. I tell my clients this all the time. Like, I want you to be a master surfer. Like, you're just surfing the waves of circumstances. I mean, this is the human experience. Shit is going to go down. Things are going to happen. But how you approach it, whether you let it knock you off your surfboard or you just adjust your weight a little bit and just ride the waves, that is everything. And so I hope this discussion really helped you understand what it could be like if or when you are ever sued. And so I will see you guys all next week. I hope you have a lovely week. It is holiday season, and I hope you have some time off and spend time with loved ones and you take care of yourselves. See you all next week. Hey, when you got into surgery, when you were bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, you told yourself a story that it was going to be amazing, and it's not. That's okay. If you want to learn how to navigate the landscape of life after training, you are in luck. I have created a course just for you. It's called Empowered Surgeons Curriculum. It gives you everything you need to learn that you didn't learn in training about how to be a human in the world of surgery. All you have to do is go to courses.melthackercoaching.com/courses/empowered surgeon or click the link in the show notes. See you inside the course.